How about now? All right. Okay, well, if you didn't hear me, the state's got big problems, big budget problems. That's our governor, and he's got us in a bit of a hole, and he's having a pretty ugly week. I was in Sacramento, and saw him going into a negotiation with the legislatures there. That was how he was dressed. So, but things aren't good there, and so he said to the UC faculty, look guys, you're just on furlough, and if you can, just go out, start businesses, go consulting, because we just really can't pay you salaries anymore. And I thought to myself, well, I don't really know what else I can do. So I had a bit of a look at an article I got in a magazine that I subscribed to, and I thought, huh, look at that. 30.2% of people said that they're using genomic DNA data in their bull selection decisions. So I saw a business opportunity. So I'm here to announce today Vaniomics. It's a new genetics company, a new testing company, so we're going to have to extend BIF one more day so I can have the Thursday breakfast. All right? So you'll look forward to that, yes? And so we really have tests that are 105% more accurate than any other test on the market. Don't get left behind. Tests is the best. And look who's happy. Arnie. He thinks, yes, it's a business model. Now, California's a little different in terms of our bull sales, and you've got to be a creative marketer out there. I'm not sure what the bull sales are like out here in Missouri, but we have to have a little bit of marketing going into it. And so this was the model from the early or late 40s, I guess, and I thought, oh, I don't know if I want to go that route. So I put a bit of thought into what my first product was going to be, and you know, it's under duress that I'm going into private enterprise here, but I'll do what's asked of me. So I've got the Ain't Got No Choice test, which is the first genetic test coming out of Vaniomics, which lets you more accurately select those animals carrying good genes for marbling. Sounds familiar? Arnie supports it. It's the only genetic test that's been endorsed by Arnold. So as I present this test to you at the breakfast tomorrow morning, what should you be thinking about? As a potential customer of this test, there's really three things I think that you want to know. Does it work? Is it useful? And does it pay? And so I'm going to go through those three things with this particular test, and then we'll have a look at some of the more comprehensive tests as to how that's developing the value proposition for this. So let's have a look at the Ain't Got No Choice test. So the first thing that you really want to ask yourself is, do I have the information to determine does it work? Well, what does that mean, does it work? And it's something we've talked a lot about at this meeting, and that's really the question of what is the accuracy of this test, i.e. what proportion of genetic variation does the test explain in your breed? That's the number that you're going to really want to know. And as a matter of fact, I thought as I went into this business model, I would get my test independently validated in three different countries, and I've gone through that, and it had a significant association with the trade of marbling. And I found that it explained about 40% of the genetic variation. And so that basically means it has an accuracy value of 0.63. Now, if you're a little confused about accuracy values and BIF accuracy values, I want to talk about the difference between those two. Because there's an accuracy value that we use in the genetics community that's different from the BIF accuracy value. And Steve Catchman at Nebraska a couple of weeks ago had a very simple equation as to how to calculate BIF accuracy from the regular accuracy or the what's called the true accuracy in animal breeding. And so for my test, which explains 40% of the genetic variation, that's basically accuracy squared, I can go through and get a BIF accuracy of 0.23. So to look at that another way, on this particular graph, I have BIF accuracy on the y-axis and true accuracy on the x-axis. And what you can see as you go across here is to get up to higher levels of BIF accuracy, you really need to have quite high levels of true accuracy in a genetic test. So in my particular case, where I've got an accuracy of about 0.63, that comes across to this 0.27. That's basically where those numbers were coming from. And so in order to get a test of this accuracy, how many animals would I need to have had in my training population to get there? And that depends on the heritability of the trait. So let's have a look what that looks like. So I'm telling you that my test explains about 40% of the genetic variation in marbling because it has that accuracy of 0.63. And marbling is in the vicinity of about 0.4 with regard to heritability. So in order to explain about 40% of the proportion of trait genetic variation explained by the test, which is 40% in my case, and an accuracy of about 0.4, I would have needed to be on about this line here. And this line here is when you have about 2,500 animals in the training population that you use to develop your test. So a really basic rule of thumb is if you've got about 2,500 animals with individual observations, then you will get a proportion of trait genetic variation that's explained that's approximately equal to the trait heritability. However, if you use much smaller numbers, for example, you only have 1,000 animals in your training population, or only 100 animals in your training population, then it's not until you have really highly heritable traits that you're going to start getting any sort of decent amount of genetic variation explained in your test. And that's why you'll often hear, you heard Jerry Taylor speaking this morning about the fact that you need large training populations in order to increase the accuracy of tests, and that's particularly true when you're talking about traits that have low heritability. So in my case, I knew I had 2,500, and so I trained and I got this test that's able to explain about 40% of the genetic variation. Don't forget, though, I just said that the heritability of marbling is around about 40%. So although I'm explaining about 40% of the genetic variation, the other genes that I don't have in my DNA panel, I don't have SNPs associated with the remainder of those genes, are still going to be contributing to the marbling genetic variant. And that's still going to be caught in my EPD, which don't care what markers there are, they're going to explain the rest of the genetic variation. And so that's just to remind us that we're only talking about the heritable part here that we can predict with markers. There's still going to be a huge environmental effect on this trait, and so you won't always see that the animal that has the very best genetic test will have the very best marbling score, because you're going to have the environment interacting there. So then I guess the question that we ask then is, does it work? Yes, it does. It went through validation and explains 40% of the genetic variation. So then the next question and the last question and perhaps the most important question is, does it pay? So how much would a test that explains 40% of the additive genetic variation in marbling score improve the BIF accuracy of marbling score EPD? And I have three numbers up here, similar to what Sally did in the main session today. And I'm looking at a base seed stock producer that's taking ultrasound records on an animal itself, and then the dam and sire of that animal, and 20 half-sib progeny. And that, I'm going to use that model for the rest of this talk. So I'm going to take what I consider to be fairly typical performance records that a breeder might be taking. If you were to take those base phenotypic records, you get an accuracy of about 0.15. My DNA test result, I just told you, because it explains 40% of the genetic variation, that translates through to a BIF accuracy of 0.23. If I combine both of those pieces of information, then it goes up, it's not additive, you get a little bit of an increase, and that was demonstrated in Sally's slides earlier this morning. So you get a bit of an increase if you combine the two. And so the question is, how much is that increase worth to you? Because this is the status quo. We're not generally starting from zero. We're generally starting with a performance recording seed stock operation. How much is that increase worth? And so I actually put that question to a group of cow calf producers that was at a workshop recently at the Meat Animal Research Center in Nebraska. And I put that question to them in the form of the clickers that we all know and love, where you get to have a bit of individual input. And so I put this to this audience, and have a think about what you're thinking about when you're making that decision. So you've all got a vision in your mind as to what your answer is. So this is what the group at the Meat Animal Research Center thought a couple of weeks ago. So we had the people that thought that had absolutely no value to them and they were willing to pay nothing for that test. The vast majority were up here in the $1 to $20 range. And then we had some that were the greater than $500 range, although I must admit we did have some company reps in the room and I don't know who was clicking what. But let's see, maybe they're an enlightened group. So in order to make that determination, you really have to model something that you're using this test in. There's no real rational way to come up with a number without saying, well, this is my situation, and it is going to be situation dependent. So I'm going to go through a model of a hypothetical seed stock herd that I created, and I'm going to explain what I assumed in order to get the numbers that I got, okay? And I want you to all be aware that this is a hypothetical herd, and it'll be different for your herd in your situation. But this is for a seed stock herd. And so basically, this is the seed stock operation that I made up. So I'm about a 600 cow seed stock operation, and I'm having about 267 bull calves in the drop from a single year. And the model that I'm going to describe is that I test all 267 of that male drop with a DNA test for this marbling trait. Then in my stud, I'm selecting the top 3% of those males come back into my seed stock herd as replacement seed stock sires. And then I'm taking my DNA test results and combined with my EPDs, I'm going to select the top half of that bull crop to be sold as commercial ranch sires. And the bottom half of that bull crop, I'm going to cut and sell elsewhere. Okay? So I'm keeping the top 3%, selling the next 47%, and cutting the bottom 50%. Now, that assumptions that you may or may not agree with, and it may not be your situation, but that's what we envision for this particular herd. So the number of bulls that get sold for breeding each year is 125 bulls, and then I had to make some assumptions about how well they did out in the field, and so I assumed that they were out in with 25 to 1 cow to bull ratio, and that they're out there for 4 breeding seasons, and that they actually had a year-to-year survival of 0.8. And if you do all the math on that, it means that basically my seed stock operation was providing bulls to cover 9,225 females in the big picture of things. And then I had to do a little bit of economics, and so I had a 20-year planning horizon and a 7% discount rate for returns in the future. And basically what that was as the genes were going through my herd and improving my herd over time, I had to discount back those returns to current net present values. So all of the economics I'm not going to go into, but it's just those two assumptions were in there to give me what the value of that particular test was in today's dollars, because although I might buy the test today, I might not be getting the value of it I will be getting it for years to come, and so it needs to be discounted back to the current time. So then with that assumption, the next question is, well, what is my market? And so one of the markets that I chose was a feedlot maternal market. And we've spoken quite a bit about indexes here, but basically this is an index where we have a number of profit drivers, some of which are traits that are going to be realized at the processing plant, things like dressing percentage and saleable meat percentage, and other things that are going to be of importance on the ranch, things like cow survival rate, calving ease direct and calving ease maternal. But I want to draw your attention to the fact that in this maternal index, this feedlot maternal index, I've circled marbling score there. That's because that's a very big profit driver in this particular index, this particular market that I'm servicing. And that really has an impact on the fact that I now have a very accurate or much more accurate estimate of my marbling score than I did in the absence of testing. And so what I did was compared how much value I was deriving from that DNA testing that had that 40% of marbling explained. So let me go through the numbers, and I'll go through this slowly because the rest of the talk is going to be presented in this way. So my base level was comparing the performance records that I'm normally taking as a feedstock producer. So again, that was records on the individual mum, dad and 20 half-sib progeny. And basically, as a result of using the DNA test, I'm able to improve my selection response 90%. Well, what does that translate to? If you look at the value of that change, the genetic change that you're being able to accomplish as a result, A, of performance recording, and B, as a result of performance recording in addition to that DNA test, then you get an added value of about $345 per commercial bull sold. So that's the 125 bulls that are going to the commercial market. But when I add that DNA test in, that bull is worth about another $300. And that's the result of the fact that the calves he's producing are that much better for marbling, and that's a really valuable trait in this particular market that I'm servicing. So the value of a commercial bull went up about $300. However, the value of the stud sires that I'm selecting to bring back into my own herd that's been increasing the rate of genetic improvement in my herd and all of the offspring that I'm keeping and using in my herd over that 20-year planning horizon is quite a bit larger than that. And so if you look at the difference there, we're getting up into the tens of thousands of dollars as a result of the genetic improvement in that particular stud sire. So we were selecting 8 stud sires a year, and again, we were selling half our bull crop. So that's on the basis of bulls. So now let's break that down to a per test basis. So I'm testing all of my bull crop. I'm only selling 125 of them. And so if I was looking at the increased value derived from the DNA testing of commercial sires, that is picking out that top half of the bull drop, then the value per DNA test is basically the $300-odd divided by 2, because I basically had to test 2 bulls in order to pick the best one, right? So you have to spread the cost of having to test everybody over the bulls that do generate a profit as a result of those selection decisions. So the value for the commercial sire was about $165. And then if you figure out how many bulls you're keeping versus how many you had to test there, for the stud sire, you're looking at about $497. And if you add those two together, it's as high as $663 in this particular market. So that's the value return per test in this market. Let's look at another market. Now I'm looking at the grass terminal market, and that's an Australian index. All of these indexes are in Australian terminology. And basically that's an index where you've got terminal sires, but you're selling those animals on to the supermarket, the local Australian supermarket index, that don't like marbling. You won't find Australians buying marbled meat. It's not a desirable trait in the meat there. They're grass finished. And so marbling has a very small driver on the profit drivers in this particular index. So now I'll take exactly the same test, nothing's changed about the performance of that test, and go through the same exercise I did where a minute ago it was worth $663, now it's worth $14. And the reason for that is it only increases the value of your commercial sires about $6, because there's just not a lot of value to testing for a trait that's not valued in the market that you're selling those animals in. And so I think that's a kind of an important point. If you're doing tests for something that you're not getting rewarded for, it's hard to value that back. The other thing that I thought was really interesting in this is we've got basically about a $300 increase in the value of these commercial sires that are going out to that feedlot maternal index. If you have a look at where in the value chain that money is coming back, that's shown on this slide, and I'll explain a little bit what I mean by that. In the grass index, our bull price went up $7 between the two commercial bulls. And if you look at what I'm calling the processor traits, they're in the black part of these bars, and that's basically traits that are realized by the processor, things like percent saleable meat, things that, and the way that these indexes are structured in Australia, they're industry good indexes. So you have a single selection objective that moves the whole industry forward. And where that value is captured will vary. And in this particular case, if we compare the feedlot bull in the case of no DNA test we're getting about $275 of that improvement in that commercial bull is going back to the processor, and only $70 is being put on traits that are rewarding the producer. And that works fine so long as the $275 that the processor made as a result of having the improved carcass characteristics and saleable meat percentage gets transferred back to the person making the investment in the DNA testing. It doesn't work so well if there's not an efficient transfer of those funds back to the person making the investment in the DNA testing, because they're incurring all the expenses and a different sector is getting the rewards of having made that decision. And what's really interesting here is if you compare with no DNA test versus a DNA test, almost all of that $300 is going to the processing sector as a result of having these better marbled carcasses. And so a lot of selection emphasis gets put on that. Actually, to the extent that you're actually going a little bit backwards on some of the traits that you might have liked, but that's going back to the producer. And so these values are all based on this industry good, perfect market scenario. And so you have to take the numbers and be very cognizant of the fact that this is getting spread out, the value is derived from the whole industry. So that was one trait we looked at in two different markets. But I had to do a business plan in order to launch my company, and I had a look at what the competition was out there, and I might not have the exact values of the tests right there, but there's a couple of other companies out there. And what are they selling? They're not selling single trait tests, right? They're selling tests that test for multiple traits. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to compete in the marketplace, I better develop a test that also tests for multiple traits. And so I developed a hypothetical test with my, let me ask, how do you determine the value of these multi-trait tests? So we go through kind of a similar argument to what we just did for the marbling score test, and we need to know just these few little pieces of information in order to work out the return on investment for these multi-trait tests. So if you could all just whip through those numbers in your head and come back to me, it's not an easy value proposition to determine, and it's really going to be specific for your enterprise. And I put that up there a little bit facetiously, but it's really, there's going to be no one return on investment for a DNA test, because it's really going to be dependent on your particular situation. So just for fun, I did develop a multi-trait test, and in this hypothetical test, which I said I trained on about 2,500 records, just to kind of keep in line with what I was discussing before about how important the size of that training population is on your accuracy of your test, I just basically set the accuracy of my test to the heritability of the traits that are in my selection criteria, or what I had in my performance record. So, for example, I set, you know, birth weight to 39% of the genetic variation was explained versus only 18% of 200-day weight. And using that, I then did a very similar model to what I did with the previous example, except I had a look at four different indexes. And the four indexes were basically two terminal indexes, again, the feedlot and the grass, the domestic market in Australia. And these terminal indexes don't care anything about calf or cow traits, right? You're only interested in end product traits here. And then I had two maternal indexes, one to service the feedlot, one for the domestic market. And there you start to see maternal traits coming in. And, of course, here's the two feedlot indexes with this huge value driver associated with that marbling score. And so the summary slide basically is presented exactly the same way as the one I walked you through a minute ago. And what we're looking at down here then is the value per DNA test that was used in my 600 cow seed stock herd that I outlined. And it basically ranges from $139 per test to $258 per test, depending upon what my specific market was, what I was trying to target. Again, this assumes a perfect market, and I just want to make that point because it's not quite like that generally. Unless you've got some sort of vertical integration or some way for the profit associated with the improvement in the feedlot trait, or excuse me, the processing trait, to be shared back with the seed stock producer who's actually investing in the pest. And a lot of these pests are going to help improve the accuracy of traits like marbling and carcass traits, because they're generally the ones that are pretty low accuracy in a ranch setting, because you haven't yet got the carcass data, and so it's likely that they will help improve the accuracy of traits that are going to be of value to the processing sector. So with that, I'm just going to summarise the main points of what I said. So if you're looking at buying a pest, the first thing you need to know is, does it work? That is, what proportion of genetic variation does it explain? Because as Sally went through this morning, once you know that, then you know what weighting to give it in your EPD calculations when it gets incorporated into your genetic evaluation. The usefulness is really going to depend on how much it improves the accuracy of the genetic evaluation at the time you're making your selection decision, and then the value of a unit of genetic improvement in that particular trait. It clearly has the potential to provide value. I mean, all of those models had a return there, but it's going to be really situation dependent, and the exact value is going to depend to some extent on the level of industry integration, and it will require to do the same thing I did here for the Australian indexes, an economic weighting of traits with MBVs of relevance to US beef production systems. And when we start having tests coming on the market for traits that we don't currently have incorporated in our genetic evaluations for things like feed efficiency, we're going to need to develop EPDs and economic weightings and incorporate that into an index to ensure that the appropriate weighting is put on that to make a financially rational decision about how much selection emphasis to put on those different traits. I do want to acknowledge Mike Goddard and Julius van der Werf, who are co-authors on this paper, and also support from the USDA. With that, I'm happy... Oh, I have one last slide here. I just wanted to show some people here have never seen Mount Shasta without a cloud over the top of it, and so I thought I'd finish with that in California. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions that might be here. I did look at that, and it's obviously you don't have to incur the cost of performance recording, and you need to know what that cost was. You can still get, in my hypothetical example where I had the level of accuracy that I did and those tests were very accurate, you could get pretty decent returns in that scenario. But I think I want to caution that I didn't say just now that it's okay to stop performance recording and we can just use DNA testing, right? I think it's pretty evident that we're going to, if you listen to Jerry Taylor this morning, you know, I think we're going to have to keep retraining these panels, and this is not the end of performance recording. And so I think that that don't read too much into that, but obviously if you take away that cost, then the value becomes that much more from the genetic testing. Yes. Well, I'm sorry. So the question, this was based on a perfect market. How do you deal with the fact that we don't have a perfect market? Well, there's two ways to deal with that fact. One, develop a vertical integration. Okay. Two is to develop an index that's going to just value the economically relevant traits of interest to you and make selection decisions according to that particular index. I'll start with you. Okay. Is there any value to the fact you can get much higher accuracy at a younger age? And that's very much the model of the dairy industry, as Kurt Van Tussel discussed a little bit this morning. And, you know, in the model that I just used, we were already using yearling bulls, so we didn't... You know, in beef, that's a little bit different. You certainly can get it at a younger age, but it's not necessarily changing the age that you're using those bulls and altering your generation interval. Theoretically, you could potentially have better accuracy estimates on yielding, and so you could make things more confidently, and maybe you could use it to do some cow herd. And I didn't even mention females in this equation, but you could do some things like that. But we don't have that ability to shave off 5 years off our generation interval like the dairy industry does, which really makes that thing pencil out so much more nicely. Yeah. Well, when it went backwards a couple of, whenever that was, you'd be selecting for the wrong ball, wouldn't you? So, yeah. Well, you have to make selection decisions for the long term, and you can't change that based on a price fluctuation. So I guess, you know, if that looks like a long-term trend, then you would decrease the value of choice in your selection index to account for that. Or if feed costs go up, you'd increase the importance you might put on a trait like feed efficiency. And so optimizing those indexes is always hard, and you don't want to be changing course every 2 months or so. You want to do a more general index that you can make slow, steady progress towards. Yes. I'm not too familiar with that specifics of exactly what he was talking about, but I do know, for example, the Harris Ranch Alliance in California has started to set up something like that, where they're sharing the value derived from the high choice, high quality partnership for quality program they have in place. They're actually giving premiums back to producers that use specified bulls in their programs, based on the percent choice they hit and other quality grade factors. So there is there are other ways to do it than being totally vertically aligned. But I think for this thing to get its truth, if you want to maximize the value out of this, it seems to me that that's a logical direction for this to take in order to maximize the value you get out of the testing. Otherwise, you won't be able to charge a higher price. It won't derive as much value, and it won't be being used to its optimum potential.